This is the fifth day of this April 2009 seven-day session. And we'll go back to our text, which is The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim. Left off yesterday in a section called Discourses from a Winter Retreat. The mind is just like the moon rising behind a mass of clouds. It seems dim because its brightness, like the brightness of the moon, is obscured and cannot shine forth. However, if the mind is purified, a Buddha will appear. The word Buddha by itself just means the enlightened one, or just enlightenment. Keep your koan bright and do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the koan should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. In some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they will put some fragrant oil in the pointed end of a horn and place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted by the smell, and once it thinks it is safe, crawls into the horn. It gets nearer and nearer the oil until finally its body gets stuck in the pointed end and it is unable to withdraw. In order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? Well, like all analogies, it's not a perfect one. The mouse is driven by its cravings, whereas motivation in coming to awakening is for a much more noble desire than just mere physical cravings. At its purest, the desire to come to awakening is for the sake of all sentient beings, not just for ourselves. This is the most powerful of all motivations to practice. And one is inspired to do so in order to be a vehicle of service to the world, in order to purify oneself, in order to be really be able to help others in a way in which one's intention to help is not contaminated by self-interest or even by the sense of self and other. I'm here to help you. This is a great evolutionary shift in one's spiritual practice when one's own interests, one's own selfish interests in coming to awakening are transcended by the understanding that it is only through awakening that we can really selflessly help the many beings who are suffering in this world. You should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. When you are very thirsty during a long walk in the mountains, for example, you may feel that you are about to choke from thirst and die unless you can soon drink some water. At such a time, you think only of water. If you were to dig a well to find some, you would probably die before being able to reach any source of water. Therefore, you look earnestly all around you for water until you find some. In order to resolve the great matter of birth and death, you must practice with the same lack of preoccupation with the body as the mouse entering a cow horn, and with the same urgency and earnestness as a thirsty person searching for water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. Now your practice may actually seem easy, but you should be most careful since this is a very crucial moment. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, the mass of questioning is clear and awakening is very close by. It is as though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. Soon the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death through achieving liberation from them. In order to avenge yourself of such an enemy who has tormented you for so long, shouldn't you exert yourself to the utmost? You must be determined to pass over this crucial step. Otherwise, if you let it go by, the koan will gradually lose its vividness, and it will be even harder to reach such a state again. Therefore, do not waste this opportunity. Roshi Kaplow would sometimes say at this point that in order to reach this state of mental silence and clarity that we've reached, it would take another 5 days of sitting, another 5 days of sesshin. Of course, it's not like we go back to square one after sesshin. The joriki, this samadhi power that accumulates over the course of sesshin, this drains away after sesshin. But what we don't lose is the experience, the experience that we have folded into this body mind. We may lose the memory of much of what happened, but that's different. We don't lose what we realized through the sesshin. We're in our sitting, we are changing we're changing our way of processing reality, our way of understanding it. I suppose there's some kind of new rewiring of our circuits, in small ways, usually very small, subtle ways, but there is this change that happens, and that we don't lose. Unless, I guess, maybe if you stop sitting altogether, then maybe different, I don't know. But what we have now is this mounting power of concentration. This phrase, the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death in order to avenge yourself of such an enemy who has tormented you for so long. Appreciate that this, he's not just talking about the act of physically dying after 70 or 80, 90 years. He's talking about all the deaths that we go through in our daily lives, the pain, simply the pain of feeling humiliated, the pain we suffer when we get defensive in an exchange with someone at work or someone in our family, any loss of face, any sense of even getting our feelings hurt. These are all deaths. These are all losses. Death just means that our sense of self has been injured somehow. Our ego has been bruised. These are all the deaths. These are the deaths that have tormented us for so long. What a relief it would be to be free of the pain of these things. At this time, you will automatically forget to even sleep or eat. To not let this opportunity slip by requires true wisdom. So do not waste it. Be as resolute as the Buddha when he sat for 7 days uninterruptedly. Skipped a whole bunch of pages here. Throughout beginningless eons, the way has been obscured by the great weight and depth of defilements. Exactly how heavy and deep are these defilements? They are as heavy as the earth and as deep as the ocean. Defilements are actually the habitual tendencies you have acquired since beginningless time. Since they are so deeply ingrained within you and weigh you down so greatly, how can you not see the need to practice with the utmost diligence? The defilements are like clouds covering the sun. Although the sun shines brightly behind the clouds, its brightness cannot be seen. Only when the clouds disperse will its brilliance be clearly apparent. Now, if you really want to unearth a precious gem from the mud and stones of defilements, you should think of how snow and ice harden and melt. Recently, there has been much snow here. Now it is packed and hardened on the ground and will not melt very quickly. Just look. The snow is delivering an unsurpassable discourse on Dharma. For to dissolve the defilements and discover your true nature is similar to the melting of this snow. In order for it to melt, it must be exposed to the sun. Thereupon it turns into water, which you can then use for drinking, washing, and so forth. Imagine how long it would take to melt if it were only exposed to the sun for one day and then allowed to harden again over the following 10 cold days. It is similar when you try to practice meditation. If you practice hard for one day, but then relax and enjoy yourselves during the next 10 days, how will the hardened crust of the defilements ever melt? He's drawing from this analogy of ice and water, which Hakuin also did in his chant. It is like water and ice. Without water, no ice. Outside us, no Buddhas. The ice, we can say, is the obstructions in our nature, the obstructive conditioning that we have gathered over the course of a lifetime, many lifetimes, if you will. Let's talk about great ice fields or sheets of ice in Antarctica, the Arctic, that are hundreds of feet deep. It's one of the functions of the stick, the kyosaku, is to help break up this ice so that it can more easily melt. As long as we can receive the stick no-mindedly, without resistance or fear, and in the spirit in which it's intended to help the student break up these ice jams so that the waters of our true nature can flow again. Even in the midst of the utmost quiescence, you should never let the koan fade. For if at such times it remains bright and vivid, then great awakening will draw nearer. Furthermore, the meditator should now consider the koan as his very life. When coming, the koan should be coming. When going, the koan should be going. While eating, the koan should be eating. And even while defecating, it should be the koan that defecates. If you practice in such a way, then great awakening will certainly be closer. Therefore, do not just idly enjoy yourselves to no purpose. Carefully and earnestly investigate the living koan. In conclusion, I would like to comment upon this well-known proverb, well-known in Korea, maybe China also. In the utmost softness lies the greatest strength. In the utmost harmony, the sublimest joy. In the utmost gentleness, the noblest virtue. And in the utmost meekness, the highest felicity. Only with the utmost patience does one become a sage? And then he comments, it is possible that someone might appear on the outside to be rather simple and even foolish. He may seem to have no courage, to be overly compliant and slow-witted. However, inside he may be wielding a mighty sword. Similarly, when confronting circumstances, on the outside you should appear to deal with them softly and compliantly, yet inside your mind should be as sharp as a mighty sword. A person who can act in such a way has truly built up a sound practice. I first heard about this from Roshi Kaplow, where he talked about the mature Zen person as having this pliability, this flexibility on the outside, often a gentleness, but on the inside, this iron strength of stamina, courage, unflappability, what we call in Buddhism equanimity. When we had a dedication ceremony of our Buddha Hall in Arnold Park about 33 years ago, we had a visiting teacher, a couple of visiting teachers, one of whom had known Roshi Kaplow some 10 years earlier, maybe, and so had at least one of the disciples that he brought with him to the ceremony. I had been assigned then to drive this teacher from and to the airport. As I was driving him and his attendants back to the airport, the woman in the back seat, who had not seen Roshi Kaplow for those whatever 10 years, was just marveling at how much he had changed. She said, "He's so much quieter." And the teacher, Eido Roshi, just murmured in agreement that Roshi had his manner had become. She said, "He used to be so aggressive." She said aggressively. I've heard stories, well, that can't be verified, but of what a fierce, at times obnoxious guy Roshi Kaplow was in his youth. Part of simply becoming wiser to recognize how, not just recognize how important harmony is in relationships, but to find this oneself just naturally becoming more accommodating and harmonious with people instead of being so quick to assert this strong self, the strong ego. Being able to yield, becoming more water-like. So what happens through years of ice breaking is we become more water-like. One of the great Taoist sages, I think it was Lao Tzu, said, "Water is yielding but all conquering. It never attacks but always wins the last battle." I noticed this too among the very senior monks in Japan and the teachers I met. There's this same accommodating quality of clouds and water, being strong and assertive when it's called for. But when that response isn't called for, then to have this flexibility and pliability. This is why the word in the Japanese word for a novice monk is unsui, which means cloud water. It's very much the ideal in Zen training. The koans are full of these great masters who could just roll with the challenge. It's like jujitsu, just turning with a word, with a movement, just turning in a way where the person's aggressive energy is just neutralized. He goes on, likewise, you should try to be harmonious. You should learn to like and get on well with one another and to do things for other people instead of yourself. But if you behave in a way that is contrary to the well-being and interests of others, then you will only create conflict. It is important to be gentle and not to go against the wishes of others. Even go out of your way to be helpful to other people. In this way, you will amass the noblest of virtues. We can do this in sesshin too. We can yield when it's called for. We can help, be ready to respond, to help others in little ways. He goes on, meekness is another quality that should be cultivated. Instead of forcing yourselves on others, you should learn to flexibly adapt yourselves to their needs. You should listen well to what they say and offer to help them in whatever work they are doing. In this way, you will find contentment and happiness. This may sound to some people as rather simple-minded and dubious, but this is a man of deep enlightenment. He knows what he's talking about. In this way, that is helping, extending yourselves to help others, in this way you will find contentment and happiness. And finally, he's still working his way through this verse that we read. Finally, you must learn to be patient. That was the last line of the verse. Only with the utmost patience does one become a sage. You need to be able to forbear hardships, endure difficulties, and undertake what is arduous. While practicing, you are liable to encounter difficult periods. It is important not to give up at such times, but to bear through them diligently. In this way, the strength of forbearance will grow within you, and in the end, you will become accomplished sages. Such people are able to sit on the lion throne and utter a lion's roar for the welfare of all beings. He goes on, it is still possible that even after repeated hard practice, it may seem that no progress is being made. At such times, the thought may occur that you are simply not suited for such an arduous and difficult task. Such a practice of meditation may be suitable for those who have already had a great deal of experience in the past, but not for a beginner like oneself. But to entertain such thoughts is to crush the seed of Buddhahood. It is like digging a hell for yourself. To reject this task simply because it seems difficult will only cause you to undergo further suffering wherever you are. To give up in this way will leave you far removed from awakening. The path ahead of you will grow dim, and you will be destined to endless days of darkness. In such a state, how will you ever be able to free yourself from birth and death? No matter how difficult it may seem at times, if you continue uninterruptedly to exert yourselves, your meditation will eventually mature. The defilements you have accumulated will gradually disappear, and your wandering thoughts will lessen. In this way, progress will become visible. As long as you maintain a sustained effort, why should you not finally awaken? This is really the crux of it. As long as you maintain a sustained effort, why should you not finally awaken? When, in fact, in our self nature, every one of us is fundamentally enlightened. It's not a matter of reaching some fundamentally different state from where we are now. In our nature, we are all enlightened. It's just a matter of ripening into that, realizing that that's the way it's always been. And besides, it's not a matter of all or nothing. It's not either enlightenment or nothing. As anyone knows who's done this long enough, there are endless rewards that come from sustained practice. Never ending rewards. The Buddhas and the patriarchs of the past were ordinary human beings like yourselves. It was only through their strong determination that they were able to endure beyond strength what was hard to endure, and thus succeeded in accomplishing the difficult task of awakening. The method of practice has not changed. It is the same now as it was then. We are the beneficiaries of this tried and true method of practice and training that has been refined over centuries and centuries, worked at and confirmed by some of the greatest spiritual minds of all time. This has all been worked through. We are doing what has worked for countless thousands of people in the past. We just need to engage with our full hearts, with a full faith, and everything else will take care of itself. It's only when we stop and allow doubts to get some purchase in the mind that we run into real trouble. And doubts are just thoughts. Doubts are just thoughts. When you notice a doubt in the mind, when you're doubting the practice, what all this really can do, just recognize that as a thought. And thoughts have no reality to them. They're just thoughts flitting through the mind or sticking around a little bit longer and making trouble. But they're just thoughts. This can be just transforming to recognize when a doubt is, when these voices of doubt are coming to the mind, to recognize that we don't have to buy into any of that. It's just old tapes running. Nowadays, civilization in the East and the West is said to be at a turning point. Every moment is a time of great uncertainty. We see this uncertainty today, more than 5 years ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago. If a third world war were to start, for example, no one could predict the outcome for the future of mankind. This book was published in the mid-80s. Yeah. When such turmoil is present in human society, there is always the possibility that a change in direction can take place. Not only can individual nations undergo such changes, but even the ideologies of man as a whole can change. Yes, we can. Such a time presents an especially good opportunity for your practice of meditation to progress. The world situation being so precarious, we feel impelled to practice out of the awareness that we can never tell at what moment we may die. In general, every time of great change and upheaval, such as the founding or the collapse of a nation, is very suitable for the successful practice of meditation. It is important that you cultivate a strong desire to be of benefit to mankind. Such aspiration arises out of compassion. To be motivated by compassion for others produces a much stronger determination to practice than the simple wish to obtain your own liberation from birth and death. In this way, you should earnestly devote yourselves to meditation even at the peril of your own life. Again, getting in touch with the big picture, not just one's own peace of mind, but how much is at stake with our ability or lack of ability to see through this illusory ego that is the source of suffering. Suffering on the largest scale. Finally, just skipping up to a final kind of a metaphor here. He says, one by one you may have to encounter and traverse each. I'll give first the verse. When you have to walk somewhere on a dark night, it is very difficult to clearly see the path ahead of you. You do not know whether the way will consist of mountains, deep gullies, swamps, thorny forests, or rock-covered ground. He's really talking about practice, in particular, sesshin. And then he says, one by one, you may have to encounter and traverse each of these difficult terrains. But if you do not stop and continue walking carefully throughout the night, eventually the dim light of dawn will appear in the east and gradually become brighter. As the sun rises, the path ahead will become clearer and clearer, and the difficult passages will become easier to traverse. It is similar when practicing meditation. Whatever difficulties you face at the beginning, you should learn to endure them all. Whether you are beset by wandering thoughts, overcome with drowsiness, or aggravated by pains in your legs or back, you should never allow them to distract you from the meditation. If you continuously persevere, then suddenly your firm hold on the koan will appear before you as a wide and boundless path. Being able to see the path distinctly, you should make the firm resolve to swiftly advance. Now, while keeping a firm hold on the koan, you can confidently allow the mind to be as it is. In due time, your original nature will shine forth as brilliantly as the rising sun. I'm going to close with a poem by Mary Oliver. And she puts her own words to whatever journey we may find ourselves on. The poem is called The Journey. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Stop now and recite the four vows.